You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there. Before we get stuck into the show, I would like to dedicate this episode of the Comedian's Comedian podcast to the memory of Stuart Hudson, a wonderful man, an artistic spirit, a very funny comedian, and someone who sadly passed away a couple of days ago. I gigged with him several times. We had some very funny car journeys together. And there's a lovely thing on Facebook where someone broke the news of his passing to many of us in the comedy community. And he was a brilliant one-liner comedian, very dark one-liners, but with a real twinkle in his eye. And people have started quoting on this Facebook thread all the different jokes, all their favourite jokes that they sort of say to each other to remember him. My particular favourite was, "I've taken up masturbating. Well, it gets me out of the house." What a lovely man. He'll be very greatly missed. And my thoughts and feelings go out to all of those of us that were close to him. So this episode is dedicated to Stu Hudson. Thanks. On with the show.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. Today I'm talking to Rachel Paris, who's an absolutely fantastic comic improviser, a very funny stand-up comedian and writer of comedy songs, and also improvises with the group Ostentatious, with whom you'll be familiar. If not now, then you will by the end of this interview. Before we go into it, just a reminder, you can still get tickets at sohotheatre.com for the new Soho run of live shows, which will continue, in fact, with Paul Chowdhury on the 20th of February, Jeremy Hardy on the 8th of May and Joe Brand on the 5th of June. There are still tickets available for the Paul Chowdhury one. That's coming up very soon, so jump on that. That should be a lot of fun as we find out what is happening, white people, with Mr. Chowdhury. I can't wait. He's an electrifying live act, and I've been revising his work, as I have two huge guests who are coming on the podcast soon. A couple of you worked out who they were on the Facebook group and started muttering to yourselves, but I've since clamped down on that, and they remain, for now at least, top secret. I'm about to go on tour. I'll tell you more about that at the end of the show. I mean, you know I'm going on tour anyway, but I'm literally sitting in my car outside the first tour venue, the Joker Comedy Club in Southend. And so if you can hear any traffic and rain noise, that's because I'm sat recording this in my car. More on that later with some of the towns I'm visiting. Now, it's Rachel Paris. Let's start with something we'll probably throw away. How did you find doing that mother and baby gig that we just did moments ago?
I found it really fun. It was quite nice having one of my best friends there, because you feel like you've got someone on side. Well, one and a half people, because her and her baby were there. It's quite a hard gig, isn't it, in a way, because everyone's completely distracted by their baby. Like, you're definitely, of all the gigs that you do, you're definitely not the most interesting thing in the room.
Yes, to everyone.
To everyone. Like, every single member of the audience is more interested in someone else who's closer to them than they are in you.
And who has no social graces whatsoever.
Yeah.
So did you do anything kind of to prepare for it or to ready yourself for it? Or is there any kind of, like, what's your sort of gig report of what just happened?
I did.
How well did you feel?
Well, I've done that gig twice in the last fortnight.
Oh, I see. Okay,
to the venue.
Right.
So
you
that
didn't
was
tell
my...
me that beforehand, you're a ringer.
So that was my preparation. I found they actually, Carly Smallman and Elisa, were very good at, like, prepping me for it the first time I did it, and they said, just be aware that the mums don't hear the screams, so don't mention the screams. They don't want to talk about that. And also, don't be offended if people are distracted. So that was quite good to know. Oh, and they said, because everyone's really tired and their babies are crying, jokes that normally might be a bit subtle and dry and sort of like ironic might not land. So they said, label your jokes like to high heaven, even say them twice.
Okay.
And so I did like my gym song, which is about someone showing off that they go to the gym. And it only works if you're like, if you get that it's ironic and it's taking the piss out of those people.
Yes, because if it isn't, it's just singing about how great you are.
How great you are.
To the gym.
Exactly, yeah. So with that one, I took their advice and I was like, this is from the persona of a real dickhead who's showing off.
You literally said that. Yeah. I missed that bit. Oh my God, okay.
Like a previous, like the one last week. So I think that worked better, whereas I've had it before in other circumstances. Actually, with the gym one and with I'm Amazing as well, that I suppose are a similar vibe, that if you don't listen to the setup, then you just get people staring at you thinking, God, she thinks a lot of herself, doesn't she? And you're like, no, it's the opposite.
Let's start with those two songs then, because both of them I've heard this morning. I've heard I'm Amazing before, and I love it. It's such a good song.
Oh,
tell us about the song.
Okay, I'm Amazing is a sort of X Factor style big ballad song, and it's sort of supposed to be in the vein of those songs that people like Shane Ward did that are about following your dreams and reaching your goals and believing in yourself and finding strength from within. But instead of it saying that, it just keeps saying, I'm amazing, I'm absolutely amazing.
It's, and like the subtext of those songs.
It's the subtext of those songs, exactly, yeah. Oh my God, were you there the night I first ever did it at an experimental night?
I remember it very vividly.
You're the reason that I kept doing it. Do you remember it was...
Oh, well, this has worked out very nicely.
I only just remembered that as we were talking. So it was a night with Ben Tajay and Nish Kumar and a few of the Weirdos comedy group years ago.
Where was it?
It was in Shoreditch, the Queen of Hoxton.
Yes, okay, I know it, yep.
And it was a weird sort of like character night where they ask you to prepare special material in a character, and I was supposed to be playing, they gave you the character in advance, and I was supposed to be playing...
Yes, it wasn't underground, it was dingy, but I've got it now.
Dingy, yeah. It was very dingy. And I was supposed to be playing someone who had won a sort of Glenn Close style, like a big Hollywood singer-songwriter who had won an award for it, but in the future. And so I wrote I'm Amazing in character for that night, and I was going to just throw it away afterwards. But you remember you were at that night and you said, I love that Amazing song, you should do that again. And I was like, I don't think I can do it anywhere except this night because it's for this character.
Sure.
But I did, and it turns out it sort of works.
Well, I'm really going to have to work hard to point out that I didn't set that up. Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. I remember, it's one of the songs I first think of. Whenever I think of you, I think of that song, and I think of the one that I just mentioned as well about cups of tea.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to murder it.
What's the blues song. It's like a parody of
Could
the
blues.
Could
you give us a snatch of the...
Oh, yeah. So it's like, woke up on a Monday and I'm feeling kind of blow. I've been crying over you. And then it goes like, because it's like about... you know, the blues, really big problems, but it's like, I have a cup of Lapsang Souchong and a little bit of lemon on the side. So it's sort of a piss take of the blues. I feel a bit bad because I think the blues is a very important art form.
Well, we will come back to the idea of mocking something that you love. Because I think, I mean, you clearly love singing and music.
I do.
And you, I suppose that's kind of what's almost the mark of a good parody is when it's done with love. I always think of, I don't know if you've ever seen Galaxy Quest.
Yes.
Such a great movie.
I'm really glad you have,
otherwise it's such a dud reference.
Oh my God, yeah, I love it.
But like they're taking the piss out of Star Trek.
Let me just check, this is the right, I always get them all mixed. This is one with like Alan Rickman,
Sigourney Weaver and Tim Allen.
Tim the Tall Man Taylor.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah.
Yes, like it's a parody, but it absolutely isn't just taking the piss. It's clearly written by people who love the source material.
Of course,
So we'll come back to that. But just to stay with I'm Amazing, the lyrics, I'm really interested that you wrote that in character because listening again this morning, some of the lyrics are so hopelessly badly written brilliantly.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes the rain is thick and long. Is that one of the...
Yeah, it's like sometimes the rain is really big. And the world is long and thick.
Yeah, that was it. So talk to me about that. Is that unusual among your songs in that you wrote that one in character, or is that something that you would ordinarily do?
I think it probably is quite unusual. I'm just trying to think now. I'm just going through my catalogue, my catalogue of songs.
It must be good to have a catalogue.
It's not very big. It's like a page. It's like with three songs on it. It probably is quite unusual. And it's really fun to do those... shit lyrics, basically, like deliberately shit lyrics. They're the lyrics that a lot of comedy nights get missed because people hear the I'm Amazing chorus, but that's the thing with lyrics like that in those actual songs like that Shane Ward does. I don't know why I'm picking on Shane Ward. There's lots of people who do them. That you don't notice how shit they are because they just blend in with the general vibe of like,
yes.
You know, sometimes the road is really long and your heart is bursting and all this. And the music is what takes you, like the high production value is what, you know, is what you hear. But yeah, when I'm gigging, people hardly ever notice those little bits in between, like the rain being big and stuff like that. But they're my favourite bits.
There's something, I think we already touched on it, and it's kind of pinged then in my head, something about the difference between material that makes you laugh and material upon which you can rely. Yeah, when you were talking about the baby gig and sort of really telegraphing, this next thing is about, like, you're giving the, yeah. The delicious thing about I'm Amazing is the subtext.
Of course.
And the delicious thing about the...
The gym one.
The gym song is the subject. So just to fill us in on the gym song.
Oh, so the gym song is sort of about those people who... People who want to talk to you about the things they've done that they're very proud of, but is actually really annoying because they go on and on about it. So it's about someone who just reminds you constantly that they've been to the gym, and they say that they've been to the gym like 7 times in a sentence. And like you say, really, the joke of the song is that this person is talking about it so much. But if you don't get the subtext of it, I just sound like an asshole showing off that I've been to the gym.
It's really interesting that as a musical comedian, you have the option to do exactly that, to say this next song is written from the perspective of an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, even if it's in a particular type of gig, yeah. Where you'd like, it's not something you'd normally do at a gig.
No.
But it's quite interesting the way that shifts the meaning of the bit, because I would suspect, certainly for me, listening to I'm Amazing, once I've laughed at the basic premise,
yeah.
And the last line, which is brilliant and I won't spoil, but you can buy it on Bandcamp, so yeah. I should direct people there. But once you get the joke, what there is to go back to that song to listen to it again is the lyrics and the subtlety of the lyrics. And it's quite interesting. I'm just thinking, I can't do a bit of material and beforehand say, this next bit of material is, I'm likening parenthood to dying. Do you know what I mean? And just so we're on board with that, I had a bit a couple of years ago about the phrase, plenty more fish in the sea.
Yeah.
And it would have been so useful at some gigs to just say, when I say fish, I mean potential partners, right? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now let's follow the metaphor.
Yeah.
I just want to... I don't know quite what the question is, but I'm just sort of asking about that, the difference between the material, your favourite bits of your material, and how hard you need to push down on the accelerator to sell it in certain environments.
I find that I think people listen to talking very differently to how they listen to music, which is why, like, it's not just mother and baby gigs that I do that flagging up. Like, I do it as well. Like, I do a few, like... cabaret circus nights where the room is very loud, and you know, they basically, in those circumstances, they only start listening when you start singing, and so I know what you mean. Like, it's a very sort of like comedy savvy night when people are really focused on stage and really really listening and everything, and that are used to comedic material, if you like, then I could do that in a more subtle way. And that's the way I like to perform it, is just let them discover the joke. I like the gym song. It's fun that it only gets funnier after the first like 10 times I've said the word gym. I think, yes. I say it about 27 times in the song. And then it gets funny, hopefully funnier and funnier. But I think it sometimes works better, yeah, to just make it really super clear that this is what the joke you're about to hear. People still enjoy it. It depends on the audience, but...
So there are... I mean, I guess... No, I was going to say there are two strings to your bow. There are very many strings to your bow, because we'll talk about improv stuff and ostentatious, oh, yeah. And all that stuff as well. But just staying with your kind of solo work, there's the songs and there's the talking in between.
Yeah.
So which do you find most satisfying, and at what point of the life of those bits of material?
So when I first started doing comedy, I'd only done improv, first of all. And then I thought... I wanted to give comedy a go, because a lot of my friends in improv, like Carly Smallman, who I started off with improv with, and Rob Broderick and Ben Vanderveld and Robin Clivan, they all started doing solo stuff. And I sort of thought I might give it a go. There was something in me that thought, I think I've got some funny songs. Like, I've always written songs since I was little. And some of them were a bit funny. And at the time, I just moved to London, and I was performing at some like very earnest singer-songwriter evenings. My earnest kind of, you know, piano.
You were, it wasn't just stage time; it was like you were an earnest singer-songwriter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I was trying to be an earnest singer-songwriter, but people actually, the lyrics came out quite funny, and I found it easier to write sort of in a slightly funny way.
Does that mean there was a sort of pivotal moment where you bared your soul, everyone laughed, and you went, oh, bollocks, I'm a comedian?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember?
Pretty
well,
much.
Let's talk about that moment. What was that moment
so
of change?
So I've got a couple of songs I would never perform. They're not... There's a difference between, like, pop songs that are a little bit funny and comedy songs that are, you know, written to make people actually laugh out loud. And so I've got like a couple of pop songs that I used to perform in the clubs. In the clubs, listen to me. Around the clubs, you know, that I used to perform. And one of which is like, Don't Ask to Be Friends. And it's like a kind of jaunty little jazz number about like, don't ask to be friends, don't ask for forgiveness, don't ask me to be the better man, I don't know how. And then it just starts sort of slagging off my ex. Not a real one. And that one is, I suppose it's quite funny. And my friends came to see it, but I'd never thought of it as a funny song. I just thought of it as quirky. And people laughed out loud at it. And that made me think I could probably have the capacity to write actually funny songs. So the first gig I sort of tricked myself into, I was at the in Clerkenwell talking to a few comedy people, and this woman said, I'm a promoter, and she mentioned that she was organising a cabaret type night, and she said, I'm just looking for a comedian or a comedy, you know, singer. And I just said, oh, I am a comedian.
I just lied.
And she said, really? And she completely believed me. Why would I lie?
Yeah. Why would someone do that?
And she said, oh, and she gave me 20 minutes for my first ever gig, which is quite hefty. And it was the best first gig for me that I think that I could have done. It was in East London in this weird little room full of antique furniture, and it was all kind of European avant-garde artists in the audience, and there was a painter in the corner, and there was someone doing weird drama in a cupboard in the other side of the room, and it was really cute. And I brought friends along, and I was playing on this antique little piano, and I just did three songs, one of which was a parody, two of which were new, and two poems. Okay. And I had zero banter.
When you say a parody, do you mean it was like an existing song and you changed the lyrics?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah,
bassist kind of parody.
Yeah. And I did that, and it went really well. But I look back, and it's really strange because I had never done stand up, and I didn't do stand up then. I just sort of was like, now I'm going to do a poem. Now I'm going to do a song. I hope you enjoy it. And this, I never thought I'd be able to do stand up. I would say for the first sort of year, I had a couple of little jokes just to introduce the songs, and a couple of little jokes to tail away from the songs. But it's only really, like, it took me quite a few years to get the confidence to do stand-up. And now that's kind of equal in terms of what I enjoy doing. And I'll go and not do any songs at a gig sometimes. I'll just do, you know, 15, 20 minutes of stand-up, which is quite a big turnaround from how I started out.
Do you always have the MP3 with you in case you get there?
Quite often, but I've tried to train myself not to.
Great.
And it does actually, at the same time, when, so I always used to perform the first like couple of years, I always was at a keyboard, always. And for me, the piano is such a comfort. It's like a comfort blanket, and I don't feel any at all nervous, like whatever kind of performing I'm doing. If I'm at the piano, keyboard in front of me, and I'm singing, that's fine. And I don't feel nervous as soon as I'm sitting there doing that, or standing doing that. And then when I started performing with backing tracks, when I started doing like character stuff for Live in Vegas, I needed to move around in character. So I recorded these backing tracks. And at first it was, sent shivers through me, the fact that it wasn't an instrument. And it was that same kind of feeling of, I just had to be strict with myself and just be like, no, you've got no instrument. It's just you and a microphone, and music will happen, and that'll be fine. And the same thing when I just started doing just straight stand-up, it was like, don't take the music, just force yourself. And I still find it a bit scary, it still feel, I still have to fight that instinct that everything is leading up to a song.
That's interesting. Okay.
There's such a difference between having a freestanding 10-minute routine about something. But for me, like, my comfort is it's a 10-minute routine, but it justifies itself by the fact that it ends on a song.
Of course. That's one of those things I'm not going to be able to not see. Yeah. Now, when I see people yeah. doing musical comedy, I'm like, this is a good bit, but is it going somewhere?
Exactly.
Like, and yeah, that is the place. Is it a runway?
And the fact that it's leading to a song, because you have, like, well, I don't know, but I the bit that I am most confident in as a comedian, as a performer, is... my songs, the singing and the performing and the quality of the song, as a musical thing more than as a comedic thing. So I sort of think, well, even if they don't laugh, they'll probably like my voice, hopefully.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And so the confidence that if you know you're going to do a nice song at the end of your set, it imbues everything you say beforehand with a sort of confidence. You're like, well, I'm leading up to the thing which will definitely please people at the end. And if you're not doing that, the first time I started not doing the songs, that was really scary. I just had no confidence in it at all. And I even would like reference, like, I normally do a song.
Just so you know. Oh yeah, that's a real safety.
Which is awful. yeah, as if they give a shit.
So this is Rachel, a delight to talk to, a very, very funny lady, and a really fascinating backstory, really, a really fascinating perspective on comedy. I think you'd really enjoy her stuff, so do get along and see her live whenever you can. And I tell you when you can, she's doing a Soho Theatre run from the 6th to the 8th of March with her show Best Laid Plans, which is the one we're mostly discussing in this conversation. So do that, get your homework done, and you can appreciate this episode all the more. Speaking of Soho Theatre, of course, Paul Chowdhury is the next Soho live show on the 20th of February. So more from Rachel in just a second. Obviously, I'm on tour at the moment, and as I said, I'm sitting in my car outside the Joker Comedy Club in Southend, about to go and do the very first show. I've been revising the show. There's something I never thought I'd do. Of course, it's been a while since Edinburgh, so I've been listening back to recordings that I made of the show, reminding myself of just how all the little trills, the little, you know, the big chunks of it, of course, I remember. Let's hope. But the little bits and bobs, the way they fit together, there's certain things that were sort of worked up during Edinburgh. And annoyingly, the recording I've been mostly listening to, I can't find the one from later in the Edinburgh run, so it's from quite early doors. What a lovely opportunity to discover the show all over again. Thank you to everyone that's bought a ticket so far. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of you, and that's really exciting to hear. If you fancy coming along, then I'm going to be at Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival this coming Saturday, doing a work in progress, and indeed, later that evening, I'll be doing the tour show at the Criterion. Those are both Pay What You Want. The day before that, in fact, on Friday the 10th of February, I'm going to be in Canterbury. And then after I do my tour supports for Mr. Whitehall at Wembley Bloody Arena, then the tour goes on the 18th of February to Crawley and the 19th of February to the Comedia in Brighton. The 21st, I'll be at XS Malarkey in Manchester. Can't wait for that one. The 23rd, 4th and 5th, I'm at the Glasgow Stand. That's not a tour show. That's just me doing some stand-up with an excellent lineup there, I'm sure. The 26th of February, I'll be in Dublin at Whelan's. I've never done my own show in Dublin before. I've gigged at the Laughter Lounge and I've gigged at the International. Had a great time there. Huge fan of Dublin and Dublin audiences. If you are in that part of the world, please come along to Whelan's on the 26th of February. And then the next few are, and I'll just wiggle down the list here, Exeter on Wednesday the 1st of March, Bath on Thursday the 2nd of March, Harrogate on the 4th, Birmingham Glee Club on the 5th, that should be a lot of fun, and Fruit in Hull on the 6th. I love the way the venue Fruit is just called Fruit. There's no like Fruit Theatre or anything, it's just Fruit, Hull, Monday the 6th of March. And then that, I mean, there's more Shrewsbury on the 9th. I'll just go up until until I disappear from Melbourne. Bristol at the Hen and Chicken on the Comedy Box at the Hen and Chicken on the 10th of March. And then Glasgow on the 13th of March. Newcastle 14th. Darlington 15th. Leeds 16th. And then I go to Melbourne. So there is no excuse not to come along. If you're near one of those places, do come and check out the stand-up stuff, especially if you enjoyed the little free gift over Christmas. Why not come and see some entirely different material
live. Thanks to all your donations. I've had some fabulous emails from you as well. From I'm glad to say that the ranks of people who this show has given a nudge to start doing stand-up have swelled by two or three people in the last few days. I don't think that's becoming exponential, but if it is, maybe I am gradually destroying comedy, the industry element of it at least. And thank you to those people who have told me they've got some very interesting jobs out there. We now hold amongst our listenership a hostage negotiator, an undercover police, but more than one undercover policeman there everywhere, and an ambulance person as well. So thank you to those guys who've got in touch. I shall keep your identities secret. These ambulance guys, they're very, they like to skulk. They don't like people to know who they are. They're too humble. So thank you. If you want to get in touch, if you'd like to support the show with a donation, please do that at comedianscomedian.com/donate. You can set up a recurring payment of, for example, £2 a month. Other options are available. Or if you really feel that this show has made a big difference to your life, if you would like to signal that to me in a financial way, then you can give me a one-off donation of however much you'd like. If you're a student or someone who doesn't have a lot of money, that's absolutely fine. But remember, if you are someone who can afford to make a donation for the show, you pay for those people that can't. And I think that's a really fair system. So I'm really happy to be using that at the moment and crowdsourcing like a good one. On which subject, I've had an exciting idea, and I've had two or three people go, you should definitely do that. And I've just had one person go, you should definitely not do that, and here's why. More on that later when I've decided. I know that's aggravating, isn't it? It's like someone saying, hey, there's a thing to... Oh, no, never mind. But it's just on my mind at the moment. Let's get back to Rachel Paris and find out a little bit more from her. I'll chat to you more in a bit.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Talk to me about, you said the word nice there.
Yeah.
Talk to me about nice.
Okay.
I can't remember exactly the context you used because I was too busy thinking, that's an interesting word in the context of you.
Yeah. Do you get this as well?
Tell me what you get. We'll discuss me on your podcast. We'll discuss me in a minute. Sorry. But go on. Look, I realise that isn't a question. That's probably the least question.
No,
I've just
you
said
know.
Nice question mark. Go on then.
You know what I'm going to say. So, yeah, I have found... It's really interesting. Tom Goodliffe put up a Facebook thread about this recently, about how Time Out describes you in one word, or did when it had comedy listings. And my word was often likeable, friendly, nice... They like that kind of thing, and I think I don't know.
They're not negative words.
They're not negative words, but it's the words that they don't say, like hilarious,
powerhouse,
sure. Confident. So I think I do. People think of me as quite nice, and I think my manner can come across as quite nice. But actually, if anything. I think I undercut that in my comedy, right from the beginning, really. I think that was the thing, was I'll be doing the parody I did in my first ever comedy gig is, you know, it's a, I've got a pleasant voice. It's not a powerful voice, but it's a pleasant voice. And I play the piano like a nice girl. And, you know, I seem against, for all sorts of reasons I'm not, but I seem to come across as like a nice girl. For the listeners at home, I'm doing inverted commas.
That was very nice of you to point out.
Thank you. But actually, hopefully, I think I'm sort of not being that nice and kind of trying to go to darker places and kind of undercut things. And
yes, I sort of think of you in the same, sort of towards the same sort of pole as the Beautiful South.
Like
all of my favourite Beautiful South songs are beautiful, lovely, twinkly ballads. And you listen and you're like, Jesus, that's really kind of painfully honest about stuff.
But actually, my relationship with nice, if you will, has changed a lot in the last seven. I've been doing comedy about 7 years. And like the first solo show I did, The Commission,
I really
didn't like the idea of just being myself and polite and nice and everything. And
Sorry, is that before you did that show or after?
Well, even including that show, I kind of had this character. I was sort of myself, but I kind of had this character that was like an alcoholic and like drug addled and really like messed up, and a little bit sort of even like a sociopath kind of thing. Like there are all the random like references that made me a bit darker and everything, which I think worked okay at the time, but I think I was relying on them as for shock value. But actually by now, like the last few years, I've kind of got more on board with the fact that I don't know how to say this, I sound like a prick, but that people like that I'm friendly, and actually it makes them listen. And I don't, most of the time it's nicer than people hating you. And a lot of like the reviews that I got initially, I hated people saying that, you know, she's a warm, likable presence. I remember I got one from like Corrie Shaw in Chortle, and it was actually a lovely review. And it's proven to be true, because those comments haven't gone away, no matter what I've tried to do to be like, you know, a sort of, no, I'm a kick-ass motherfucker, you know. And I'm not. And so there's something in sort of like in coming across as nice, actually, that probably helps, and I've sort of given into it.
That's interesting. Yes, having kind of kicked and screamed against it, and I suppose, well, I mean, in terms of, there's different ways to kick and scream against it, aren't there? Because what you've described there is that you tried to kind of contrive things that you thought a nastier act might say, gags that you thought were someone else's voice. I mean, is there, do you think, a level of you underneath the sort of the niceness that could be like an honest way of being like truthfully a bit darker?
Well, I think I think I'm just hitting that now, sort of these days, with like the last show I did, Best Laid Plans, is kind of, it really is just me, and it's sort of performed in the spirit in which I'm talking to you, just talking to you now, like just kind of in quite a natural way. But the subjects I'm talking about like sex and about having children and about weddings, I'm quite acerbic and possibly offensive about things like that. And that is how I feel.
Yes. And I found that show less acerbic and more, it was very kind of revelatory. It was very candid.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting. If we can talk about the content of the show, like you were talking, it's very difficult for me to talk about this as a man, but you know, there's some stuff about you having difficulty being able to reach an orgasm.
Yeah.
And I remember being really listening to that on the train. I was properly kind of like, oh wow, I didn't expect this from Paris, you know.
What? I'm on the 95 bus.
Yeah.
Chill out, Paris.
But it was really, but I don't know that it was acerbic material, but it was definitely confronting.
No, I think my stuff about weddings is quite possibly acerbic. Yeah. In fact, I did, but because I've been to like a lot of weddings. Statistically, I've discovered an unusual number of weddings.
Do you know, because I'm having to be planning a wedding myself at the moment, I really, your joke about, I often get asked to play the piano.
Yes.
It suddenly made me thought, oh God, who am I relying upon for things that they always get relied upon?
And I've had to like cut out certain lines because certain friends came to see the show who I was literally talking about them.
That's funny. Well, but again, that's quite revealing as well, in that you cut those things out so as not to rock the boat.
I know. It is isn't it? But the thing is, like, I do feel that way, but at the same time, so I have occasionally done that. I remember doing a gig, sorry, I'm sort of going off on tangents, but I did a gig in Leicester, and I used to do, this is years ago, it was the commission as well, and the odd line about, it was a song that was a really, really short little song. It was like, I held you in my arms forever, remember when I bought you flowers, something, something, and now you're dead. And it was really short, and it got an easy laugh. And I was, I remember, like, just doing jokes about, like, sudden death, thought that was quite funny at the time, and I think a lot of young comedians, new comedians, I mean, do it. But there was something, there was a line that I used to say about that. I can't remember exactly what it was, but my friend, who has been horribly bereaved in her life, came to see the show, and I was like, why would I put her through that? I know that's going to upset her. So I cut it out. And I know what people say. I know they say, you know, you don't know who's in your audience anyway. You know, there might be, any night of the week, there might be someone who finds that offensive. And I know that's true. But if I know for a fact one of my best friends, if I know that, then I'm not going to upset her deliberately. But I, you know, you can't help it the rest of the time. Anyway, what were we talking about?
We were talking about the, about whether or not there is a darker kind of thing under you. Because let's talk about some of the other content of Best Laid Plans, which was some of the stuff you talk about, letters that you wrote back and forth to the Samaritans.
Yeah.
So how much of that was true?
A lot of it.
You were emailing rather than...
Emailing them, yeah. So
that's
I had
in itself. I mean, that's very good. I don't want to bother you when you've got a moment.
Well, yeah, so this was like last year, and I was just feeling really sad. It's interesting, that show's kind of been a bit hijacked by the press and taken up as a mantle for depression. And I don't know that, I certainly don't use the word depression in the show, because I have a lot of friends with like clinical depression, and I don't know enough about it to say what it was. I just say I was really, really sad and it wouldn't go away. And so there was this one night, which was a really shit night, and I got home and it was late. I suppose it felt too late to call them. It was like midnight, and I
they knock off at 9.
They've clocked out. Yeah. And I say in the show, you know, I've got very good friends who would and did listen to me, you know, during that time. But there's something, there's, I don't know, a particular feeling that you might have where you just want to talk to someone who doesn't know you. And so that was perfect for that. And I just Googled, I didn't know if you could email them or not, but I Googled them and they're like, yes, you know, you can, and there's the email address there. So I emailed them. And I think there's just something in just telling someone that you're not okay, just typing the words, I am not coping. And this is all in the show, so that's all true. So the first letter that I wrote to them was, on the one hand, very simple and like, serious and like, I'm not coping, I don't feel like I know what I'm doing with my life and all of that, and on the other hand, absolutely ridiculous. And I really did, you know, I had no intention of using it in a comedy show, but looking back I sound like such a tit. And they wrote back, and that's in the show, and I wrote again to them and that's in the show, and then the following letters are not real.
Okay. Yeah. But so the ones that are real, are they completely real, or have you embroidered them?
I might change the odd word, but yeah, pretty much word for word. Okay. Yeah.
And how does that feel to be sharing something so intimate? Was there a cathartic quality to it?
The first few times I talked about it in previews, because this show, I'd written an entire hour that I'd been previewing for 6 months before. Before I sort of went through a breakup, which has caused me to write to the Samaritans. So this show was a completely different show, which I thought I was so well prepared for Edinburgh. And then I broke up with someone and it sort of changed. So the first times I sort of talked about this in the show was very nerve-wracking. And the main thing that was nerve-wracking was that it felt a bit self-indulgent to talk about it. I think I quite often feel like that in comedy. I think that's quite a big worry, is that, is this for me? Because I probably am getting something out of this. And is this actually, yeah, therapeutically. And is this actually interesting or not? And then I've had a sort of director who was watching, John Luke Roberts, and he was like, that Samaritan's bit that you did, which I hadn't really told him that I was going to do. He was like, that's more interesting than a lot of the other stuff that you're doing. So don't make it a 5-minute segment, you know, don't make it a throwaway thing. Like talk more about that. So, when you say, I don't think I realized, a lot of people have asked me like about sharing what is something quite intimate. I don't think I realized that. I think when I wrote to the Samaritans, I sort of assumed like quite a lot of people did, had done, but actually turns out not that many people have. So it was nerve-wracking the first few times I did it, but now it feels like a show, you know, because I've been performing it for a year. So
yes. And I mean, the not to give away the ending of the show, but it's a much more hopeful message by the end of the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you think that doing the show had an effect on your happiness, or was it that were you kind of revealing a thing you'd gone through but were now out of, or were you revealing a thing you were still undergoing?
The course of the show, from like previews, which was about 3 or 4 months, and then Edinburgh every day, and then a few more, and then now I'm taking it on tour now. So it's a long time. The first few times I did it, and I think into Edinburgh, I was still, I don't want to say recovering. So, like,
You're allowed to say you were recovering. I feel like I might be wrong, but I feel like you're sort of being hazy around it out of respect for people with worse problems.
Yeah.
But let's just talk about your problem.
Okay.
Okay, don't feel you have to say that. I think we've covered that enough
now. Covered that.
No one's going to be listening to this tearing their hair out going, yeah, oh, I've got a real problem.
Yeah. I think that's the problem. And I think, I say in the show, actually, this is a huge part of, like, my comedy and what I feel comfortable talking about on stage, is that I've been brought up in to kind of get on with things and don't moan. And the best thing to do is to just keep on with your life and don't stop and feel sorry for yourself. And that has served me very well always. I don't know if it's to do with Methodism or to do with just having a very, like, my mum is incredibly good at just getting on with things. She's had a lot of incredibly difficult things happen with her life, and she's had to get on with them, and she's chosen to, and she's brought me up to do that, and that has served me really well. But it makes me very aware that there are people with much worse problems. And all I had was a breakup after, like, you know, 3.5 years. It's not a divorce, there's no children involved, and all I got was very, very sad, and it's not as bad as people with depression, but it was the saddest time. It was probably the saddest time that I've had in my life. So that's all I, like you say, that's all I can talk about. And so it took me longer than I expected to feel good again. So for the first sort of 4 months, certainly, of doing that show, it felt like I was still experiencing it and going through it. There's one song in it that's very much about the breakup, that the first few times I sang it, I had to try not to break, because it's not a funny song. I know. I think by the end of Edinburgh, I don't think the show was like especially therapeutic. I think it's just time passed. Enough time had elapsed that I was kind of getting through it and getting on with life. But that is the song that I broke at the first few months.
Which song?
It's a song called Because, and it's about when you break up with someone, even though you still love them, and even though you still love each other, and that love isn't enough, and there's being a grown up and realizing that there's bigger things, which is hard.
Tell me about Methodism. Are you a Methodist, or are you from a Methodist family?
Kind of neither.
And what does it mean? I don't know anything about Methodism.
So, my mum's a Methodist. I should have said this may be one of the... My mum and dad have basically forbidden me from talking about them. They're really into their privacy on stage or on this. So,
okay.
Might come back to you about this. But
okay, sure.
But yeah, I was brought up Methodist, christened in the Methodist church. And so my mum's Methodist and my dad is, but my mum more, I think. Okay. And they're both very involved with the church. And and I was the organist for our church growing up from the age of like 12. I was like this little sort of prodigy child playing the church organ on the circuit. But then quite soon, like sort of 15, 16, I never really believed in it. And they never pushed me about it. I remember I went on like one of those young alpha courses, which was just really fun, mainly. Just had a lot of fun. And I've always enjoyed talking about these things, about religion and about, you know, sort of like spiritual matters and things like that. And I'm interested in it. So I enjoyed the alpha course, to be honest. But at the end, most people sort of got confirmed. That was kind of the point. It was leading up to confirmation. And I was like, oh, no. No, thank you. No. If anything, I definitely now don't want to.
Yes. Do you want to be religious?
No. No. I enjoy the church. Not the horrible bits, but not anything to do with like shit beliefs. I'm going to say shit beliefs about like, you know, homophobia or like what I think of, you know, I don't agree with like no sex before marriage or anything like that. But I've been in it a lot. Like I was brought up in the church and I was the organist. I was also in a Christian rock band.
Unbelievable, right?
I was on keys and vocals.
What was the name of the Christian rock band?
Didn't really I think it was called like, I can't remember, like Bethel Sing. It wasn't a very good name.
Okay.
But we were good. And then I went to uni and I sang in like medieval choirs and in the church choirs in Oxford, and so beautiful old, you know, ancient buildings, candlelit services, and the music that we were singing, like sort of stuff like Bird and Talis, is like, I loved it. I loved singing it. I loved being a part of it. And then I had a job as a choral singer after I graduated. I was working in, like, I was trying to save money to get to drama school, so I was like working in a music shop and cocktail waitress, but I also had a job doing choral singing at this church in Oxford, and they gave you cheap rent for it, and I really enjoyed that as well, like the aspects of it. It was again a different kind of music that I was singing, and they had recitals in the church, and it was a nice thing. It's just a nice thing to do on a Sunday, and I never haven't believed in all of the tenets of it, but I think having somewhere to go and sit and reflect and listen to beautiful music is a good thing. I've always thought that, and so I feel very comfortable in churches, but I can't pretend that I believe in a lot of the Jesus stuff.
Yeah, I can't believe in a lot of the yeah. Jesus. Yeah, it's interesting. The reason I ask is I sometimes think I would like to be religious.
Yeah,
I don't believe. So that rules me out.
Yeah,
but, I do think a lot of the software seems quite successful software.
Yeah.
It's like being into NLP or something. You sort of go, yep, got a friend, someone's got my back, got a thing I can confess to.
Exactly.
Got a belief in an afterlife. All of these things are brilliant.
Were you brought up at all with religion?
No, not parentally. The school I went to for most of my childhood had kind of chapel twice a week. And I hated the school, and so I resented the...
Oh, yeah. I still find myself in times of either like great happiness or great sadness, still, even though I know I don't believe in it, but I still throw out something, a little, we could say prayer, but I feel like the word prayer is so much attached to, like, you know, this very specific figurehead, but I send something up into the sky, and as I'm doing it, I sort of say the words in my head, and it must be like muscle memory from growing up with it, but I say the words in my head, I go, I know I don't believe and I'm sorry. but if you do exist, you know, help or thanks.
And presumably, I don't think it's unfair to think that if you do exist, you'll forgive me.
You'll forgive me.
That's the angle, right?
I sort of send up a little, like, no offence. No offence, God. And it's weird that I still do that. It's not often. It's just like, you know, certain times when it strikes you.
Yes.
Weird.
That's interesting. That's not something we've really talked about on the podcast before. I suppose I have, I suppose it makes me a humanist, but I don't really understand what any of the terms are.
No, I'm not clear.
I sort of think that I find all of the kind of glee and joy from humans, from stuff that's definitely demonstrably here. But having said that, I do think there's a benefit to ritual. And I don't really have a lot of rituals in my life. Kind of gigging is probably as much as...
Yeah.
Oh, God. Maybe I'm religiously addicted to stand-up because there's a ritual and I get to confess. Yeah. Oh, God. This is awful. That's interesting.
Apparently, I heard that, like, evensong services in universities around the country are finding their attendance, like, doubling in the last few years. And I don't think it's because more people are actually believe in that religion, whether it's, like, you know, high church or C of E or whatever. But I think it's just, you know, in this time of, like, turmoil and, you know, the world is changing and it's a bit scary, I think it's nice to have somewhere to find, like, solace and peace. And there aren't actually that many places, apart from the church, where you can find that, which is a shame.
So did you grow up with brothers and sisters?
Yes. I grew up, well, in the house was, like, two older brothers. So Matthew, who's quite a bit older than me, is, like, 14 years older than me. And my brother Preston, who's 5 years older than me, the one who's had a baby, who I talked about. In the show. So, yeah, older brothers. And then I've got halves as well, who are older than me.
Okie dokie. So your parents were religious?
Yes. I should just say, so I feel like I can't talk too much about my parents. I'm sort of not allowed.
Okay.
I think it's fair to say that they've got a very strict sense of privacy, which I can understand. And, like, they're not really on the they're certainly not on God, Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. And my dad still doesn't have, like, a mobile phone or anything, and they've got a real sense of sort of their own space and of, well, just privacy, really. But I know that they've made it very clear that they don't want to be a part of my material.
Okay.
Which is totally fair enough, but I find that quite difficult sometimes because they're fascinating. I think they're fascinating, and they're everything that parents are. They're wonderful and they're difficult, and there's a lot to say there, and we're very politically different, wildly politically different, and so there's so much I want to talk about in my comedy that I don't think they'd find offensive, but I feel like I can't. Well, I know that I can't because I don't want to upset them.
That's really interesting. I think I have never done any jokes about my mum. Never done any jokes about my mum.
And is that because it hasn't come up, or because you don't too?
I don't want to upset her.
Yeah.
And I also think that I mean, we do jokes about things that bother us, right?
Yeah.
And for me, increasingly.
Yeah.
And so I've done, in the early days, I had a lot of jokes about my dad, not because my dad bothered me, because it was just easy to make fun of him because he had funny dad things he did. And he was like, he's a guy like me, and, you know, maybe I'll turn into him, all that kind of area.
Yeah.
But they weren't sort of difficulties. They were me sort of celebrating him. And as much as I might also celebrate my mum, like, she has we've got a slightly complicated relationship to her watching my stand-up. And I think that is because she worries that she will be offended.
Yes.
And I think I accidentally gave her reason to think that she would. And so there was a misunderstanding years ago, which has ended with her... Or not ended, but the current situation is that she hasn't seen me do stand-up. And that's always been a real bugbear of mine. And I think it's partly to do with that. I feel like I don't want to do any jokes about my mum in case it gets back to her.
Mm-hmm.
But... And it could, conceivably. But it's also because I don't feel license to make jokes about my mum. So I don't feel creatively flowy about it. Because every time I think about a funny thing she might have done or said, I think, oh, well, I don't want to offend her. And it kind of freezes up the creative muscle.
Totally. Yeah, that's how I feel. I don't have license to talk about them. And that isn't me being paranoid.
Yeah.
they have withheld the license. Which is a shame, because a lot of the things I would want to say are just, like, quirky things that they do. But I think it's what you said about it depends their relationship with your stand-up. Like you say, your mum hasn't seen you do stand-up. Like, they've been, like, incredibly supportive, especially considering I think really they don't really understand why I'm doing it. I do sometimes wonder if I'm doing the right thing all the time.
Must be nice to have options.
But of course, but what I remind myself, when people say, why did you do comedy? I do comedy because that's the first thing that I did well at. Like from the very first gig, people said yes to it. Like there was a woman in the audience who said, oh, I'm from Funny Women, you should enter Funny Women. From the next gig, I went on another gig, you know, and then I got an agent quite, and I'd been doing piano and I'd been doing acting and I'd been doing improv and like comedy. It seems like I had options, but none of the other options. I tried other options, and this is the option that it said yes to me straight away, and that's why I've carried on doing it. But you still, yeah, I still have times when I'm like, I hope I made the right. I hope that was the right call. I'm not very funny in real life, really. I'm quite a sort of serious person. I'm not someone who's like really confident and sort of the life of the party. I wasn't the class clown at school or anything. If anything, I can be pretty boring. And so I quite often think, you know, there's some people who are like a natural comedian, like they're funny all the time. And who's like a perfect example? So you think you're funny. Show me the funny.
Patrick Monaghan.
I was thinking
Patrick Monaghan. I thought, no, don't say that. Let Rachel come to her own.
Yeah.
Patrick.
I think Patrick is one of those people who is just born to be a comedian. Like he's so funny on and off stage. And when he's on stage, he's just completely himself and the audience love him. And he just chats to people and he doesn't even need to have material. He just makes people laugh. And I'm so not like that, you know. I have my material that I do on stage, and so it does make you question, like, I wasn't born to be a comedian in the way that some people were. And so you're constantly like, am I doing the right thing with my career?
Yes, there must be a certain comfort in thinking, well, that was a bad gig, but I am unshaken in my belief in what I should be doing.
Exactly.
So do bad gigs shake you?
Yeah. Yeah, all the time. Like a bad gig doesn't make me think, oh, you know, is that material working? It makes me think, you shouldn't be a comedian. You've made the wrong choice.
You poor bastard. I've been through a lot of that. I mean, I'm pleased. I'm sure neither of us have that many bad gigs anymore.
Yeah,
I just stress that.
Yeah.
But
it just takes one. It just takes one in like, a few months period. And you just have one. You're like, if this was the right thing... If you were a real comedian, you couldn't have that bad a gig. Like, you'd know how to rescue it. And I just think, you've got to give this up.
You must know as well on some level that everyone goes through that.
Yeah, they do.
So you
and they
now,
talk about
a
it.
A good gig earlier today in the bank.
Yeah.
You must be aware that that is just illogical.
Was that a good gig? Did you think it went well?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, you can't ask me for jokes, or was that a different question?
No. I genuinely can't tell. Well, it was hard to tell
it
with
was,
that one because there's
it was a ridiculous,
babies everywhere.
Yeah, it was an out of the world gig. It was a different sort of a thing. But do you know what I mean? Like, sometimes that, like, when I'm feeling like, hey, everything's working, so much more easy to think, God, isn't it weird how sometimes I get all blue? And then the next time you're depressed, or you know, whatever the word is,
yeah,
then you're like, oh, this is the real me.
Yes,
this is the real version.
Yeah. And you think, God, amazing that I can pull it off.
How do I sometimes
for a lot of the time
myself into thinking I'm happy?
Yeah,
yeah, right.
Yeah, it's amazing how I can take people in, like, you know, 90% of the time. This facade is like incredible, but yeah. But actually, I am shit at comedy.
Isn't that interesting? That's almost an autobiography title. Is like, my facade is rock solid.
Yeah.
If the facade is rock solid, maybe it's not a facade. Maybe you are just good. So, one of your songs is I forget which one is it in. It's about Don't Trust a Singer, We Don't Know a Thing About Your Life.
Oh, that's from Live in Vegas, my difficult second album.
Go on. Well, that's interesting because I listened to some of it on Bandcamp. I didn't see the show, but
well, I think it's because it was a character show. It translates less well to recordings without the stage stuff. You know, all the songs are completely imbued in the act that I do on stage.
Oh, I would have said, just having listened to a few of them, I was like, oh, I completely get what character this is coming from.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
I felt like,
good.
Oh, great, I've dodged a bullet. Yeah. Didn't need to see the
future. That show was me trying to do character stuff. And I say that as though I very much thought of that show as a failure. for a long time, and I didn't do Edinburgh the year afterwards because I just felt it was a difficult Edinburgh. Just not many people and not great reviews, and I just found it quite hard. And it transpires, I think I'm much more comfortable being myself on stage. But, you know, you can only write what you've got in your head at the time. And all I had that year, I'd done my first solo show the year before. I'd used up all the material I'd been gigging for 3 years. And then all I had was this character called Felice, who's like a Las Vegas lounge singer, who's incredibly full of her own, full of herself, and really, really outlandishly egotistical, who sings like, yeah, don't take my advice. And then I gave her I'm Amazing because it suited her so well.
Okay.
So I had that idea, and then I fleshed it out with some other characters as well. So yeah, but I sort of, the show got better. I rewrote it when I did it at the Soho Theatre and did a better character than one of them. But
were you up at the festival being aware that you were having a bad one?
Yeah.
How did that feel? Because I've been through that in 2011.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You don't notice, yeah, do you? You don't notice.
Huge deal to you at the time. Afterwards, make more stuff.
No one knows. Like people would say to you, like, oh, you know, I saw you in Edinburgh. You got great reviews, and I was like, and you just go, okay, no, I didn't, but I'm glad you think I did.
It took me a long time to stop saying, no.
I didn't. No,
let me explain why it was so bad and why I'm castigating myself. Yeah.
I have learned that, to just go, sure. I did. Yeah, it felt horrible. And every other Edinburgh, so I've been doing Edinburgh for like 10 years, and before I was doing solo shows, you know, I did like all the two-handers and I did acting and improv and all sorts of things. And that was the first Edinburgh where I cried like several times. And with a character show, the one I'd written, I went and got changed quickly behind a screen that was on stage. And in the last few days, I hated the show so much. I was so sick of it and I was convinced everyone hated it. And that if I stopped the show, the audience would be glad to go home. And every time I went behind that screen, I was just thinking, I don't want to go back out. Please don't make me go back out. And how great it would be if I could just stay here and the audience would just leave. I really didn't enjoy it.
I could really see where that story was going. I've never had a show where, like a stand-up show, where there's the opportunity to go off stage.
To hide.
And sometimes I think that's a good thing.
It's
the idea of just leaving and going, oh.
Yeah, having a break, having a little moment to like reflect on the pain of the last 5 minutes and to think about what you're about to do and go on with your last character.
From where did you summon up the let's get through this? Was it just that torture? Or did you find
I just got over myself. You know, it's horrible and you know it's going to end. And some people did actually enjoy the show. In fact, some people think it was a good show. But it didn't feel like me. It didn't feel comfortable. And there were enough people who didn't get it. It was a strange show because it looked from all the branding like it was a sort of glitzy, genuine glitzy cabaret sort of show about Las Vegas. Whereas in fact, what it was kind of like a satire on American society.
Yeah, so if people came there expecting tits and teeth,
they did not get that. Yeah. I just got on with it. I'm not really, I don't go and, you know, cry in a corner. I just sort of get on with things. So I just got on with it, but I was sad.
When did you start doing Ostentatious?
In about 5.5 years ago. So 2012.
I don't know a huge amount about Ostentatious. I have never seen it because and this is a guilty secret.
You've escaped
I've
it.
I've always felt like it wasn't aimed at me because I don't think I'd understand Jane Austen.
You don't need to. You don't need to. That's your first mistake.
I mean, God, it lends itself to a good picture,
it's
doesn't
not,
it?
Yeah.
what a team.
It's not. We get that a lot. Like, Well, it's changed now because I think more people know what it's about. But like, we used to get a lot of like men dragged along by their girlfriends reluctantly, and then they'd come out and be like, "Oh fuck, I thought that was going to be for women and girly, and it's not. It's very, you don't have to know anything about Jane Austen, and it's not, you know, sort of feminine. It's very
is
reverent.
It an improv show with hats.
It's sort of. So there are Jane Austen references for people who know about Jane Austen. So we give them little like Easter eggs. Is that the phrase?
Yeah.
But if you don't know anything about Jane Austen,
I think the phrase, if the show is called Ostentatious, I don't think they're Easter eggs. I think they're content.
Yeah. So we do. I think it's fine for everyone, but it really doesn't matter. And we get children coming, and we get 90-year-olds coming, and also, like, interestingly, even though as a group we're pretty left wing, almost entirely. It sort of appeals to, like, across the sort of political spectrum, interestingly, which is something we didn't think about.
That's interesting. So you chuck in a little UKIP joke,
yeah,
and it gets a funny reaction.
Yeah, because in the show, we get the audience to suggest the title. So the title of the show that we do is picked out of a hat at random from ones that they've put in before the show starts. So, like, for example, when Brexit happened, for, like, months around Brexit, everyone was suggesting, like, Brexit and Darcy, or the Brexit affair. And so we ended up doing lots of shows about Trump, about Brexit, about Clinton. And we'd be doing it all a lot of the time from, like, just sort of subconsciously, because obviously you can't plan what story you're going to do, but just subconsciously your liberalism weeps out of you. So we'd end up with, like, sort of probably a sort of slightly liberal message, and you can tell it depends, because we play, like, a lot of, you know, little sort of home counties theatres which might be a bit more right wing than we are, and they'd still enjoy it. And sometimes it slips through unnoticed, but sometimes there's a bit of a well, I'm not sure I agree with you, but it's very funny.
Yes, I like the hat.
I like
much.
The hat. Yeah.
So are you one of the core members?
So who is
you and Carrie Ed and Andrew?
There really were. So, that was sort of like the very, very first few days. It was sort of me and Amy Kilcodgson who sort of thought it up.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
The idea to do
I'm just naming my friends there in Italy.
Yeah. sort of Austin style show, or a sort of like narrative of, like, based on an author. And then, yeah, the six of us were together within, like, a few weeks. So that was Cariad, Lloyd, Joseph Morpurgo, Graham Dixon, Amy Cook Hodgson, Andrew Hunter Murray, and me. Is that six? Yeah. And then Charlotte Gittins joined like a couple of years later, and now I've got Daniel Roberts. So there's eight of us now. But it was when it was the six of us that we came up with, like, the name and the proper format and everything. And it's always been, like, very co-op, very democratic in the way we run it. And it's been crazy. Like, we just started it, like, the way a lot of it, most improv, as you know, like, you don't expect people to pay for it. You don't even expect people to come. And we were just doing it in a pub to 15 people. And it just straight away people wanted to come and see it, like, immediately, before it was even a thing. So, like, we started out in a 15-seater, and that sold out because it's 15 seats. And then we moved to, like, a 60-seater, and that sold out. And then we moved to a 100-seater.
Is this within one festival or across festivals?
This is before we went, like, because we were going for about a year and a half before we did our first Edinburgh.
Okay.
And we moved to, like, bigger venue and bigger venue. In London, we were doing it about fortnightly. And it just kept... It was crazy. Like, it just kept showing its popularity. And now, you know, like, a few years ago when it became, like, a company, you know, with dividends and VAT, about which we know nothing about. None of us know about these things. And we've had to learn how to run a business. And it's a huge...
So how often do you do it now? How often does it...
Now it's once a month in London.
In what size venue?
400-seater.
Leicester Square?
Yeah.
Okay.
We take on a national tour every year. So the last one was about 25 dates or something. And then we do little literary festivals as well around the country. So,
God, and you don't have to write it.
You don't have to write
and
it.
And you can take the same show every year. Because it's not the same show every year.
It's not the same show, yeah. Yeah, but it's a lot. None of us, like, foresaw that coming. The idea of having to, the business side of things, of having to run something, it's wonderful and we're so grateful for it, but the amount of admin, but my point is, we run it all ourselves. We each take the same amount of work of admin. We haven't got an agent, you know, we just sort of, like, we do it all ourselves, and every decision that is made about the show we vote on and we decide.
Surely one of you has a louder voice or more of a...
The women are louder. Okay. the women are probably sort of a bit more vocal, I think, in terms of how it's run, but I think that's just our personalities. But no, it really is. It really is equal. Like, even if one of us is like, I think we should do it this way, we talk about it and we make sure everyone's on board.
And presumably at festivals, there is a knock-on effect whereby you can exit fly off your own shows.
You would think. I think it helps, but okay. I know. I really wish that was the case.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
But actually, unless it's unless your solo show is quite related to improv or Jane Austen,
yes,
it doesn't really translate that much. And sometimes people come to my shows. If they do, it's sometimes bad because they buy a ticket based on ostentatious, and they're like, "Why is this girl saying fuck? Why is she talking about the Samaritans?"
So what are you now? I know comparatively little about impro or improv, as we're all calling it nowadays.
Yeah.
So did you train in that?
Yes. Yes.
And what was the most useful thing that you gleaned from your training? Because I imagine improv training can be done well and not so well.
Yeah, I would agree. And I probably had a less, I don't know, maybe less formal training than some people. So I learnt with the Oxford Imps, which is a short form improv group in Oxford. It's sort of a student group, but sort of not. Like, I wasn't a student when I was in it. I just lived in Oxford. Ditto Amy. And they just pass it on year after year from the people. So like, someone's been in the group 3 years, they teach the first people.
Okay.
So I'm not learning from, like, you know, a 45-year-old master of improv. I'm learning from a student. But they were the great teachers, and they knew what they were talking about, and all the things that I learned in the Oxford Imps in my training. So they trained you for like a term, and then you perform from then on, and all the things I learned there, I've then gone on to do classes with, like, you know, Chicago teachers, and with Crunchy Frog, and with like Monkey Toast. We've got these inane names. And the FA, so the FA has like got teachers from UCB and from the Groundlings, and I've taken all courses, and the message is the same. You know, my training was a good training. The thing that I learnt, there's so much to learn. A lot of people would want to do. I had a comedian who shall remain nameless the other day being like, "Hey, I really want to do improv, but I don't want to go to any classes or anything. Can I just join a group and do it?" And I was like, no. It's hard. It's not for everyone, and you need to practice and learn how to do it, and there's lessons and there's rules, and there's a lot to learn about how to do good improv on stage. What is the best thing that I learned? There's so many. I suppose for me, it depends on your personality. For me, people think the hardest thing is thinking up what to say. What about if your mind goes empty? But actually, it's often the opposite. It's that you've got too many ideas and you don't know which one to choose, and they might not match with the person who's on stage with you. So for me, the best lesson is let your shit go. It's that you might have what you think is the most fantastic comedic line or idea, or in the case of ostentatious, you've solved the plot, you know, because we're weaving hopefully quite a complex, interesting plot as we go along. And you're like, oh, I've got it. So if she is actually being unfaithful to this man, and then he's gone to war and she didn't die after all, then we can get married at the end and it'll be delightful. And you've got this in your head, and someone comes and stamps all over it. You just have to let that happen. You just have to let it happen and embrace it and say yes. And go, oh, yes, my brother is back from the dead with a baby that I gave birth to 6 months ago.
Okay. And conversely, what is the least useful thing you've learned? Have you ever sort of felt, oh, I'm being taught something I don't agree with there? Because I would imagine when everyone has an opinion, everyone is sort of constantly training and teaching and learning together. Is there room for that to go wrong?
The thing that I found interesting taking classes now, and I've been doing it for 10 years, and so it's really interesting to take courses that have different ideas about how to do different kinds of improv. And I wouldn't say that I haven't been taught anything that's wrong, but I've been taught things that it's not how I like to do it personally. And I've been taught quite an American style, which is that you come on with the idea of what the game of the scene is going to be. Okay. You sort of like, you only come on if you have a clear idea of what is going to happen, of what you're trying to give to your partner. And that's not for me. I really like the idea that you both come on with nothing and you build it together. And for me, that's true improv. And I think it's...
The other one is sort of feels a bit more like it's having a clever idea.
Kind of.
And then starting to improvise.
Yeah. But I know they think that that makes for better improv. It's more dynamic and it's kinder to your partner because you're giving them something. But I really like the things that come out of absolutely nothing. You both come in. Some of the funniest things we've done in Ostentatious have been from two people coming on stage and just... They're so nervous about the, like, not nervous, but they have absolutely shit all in their head. And they find the scene from the angle of someone's wrist or from the expression on someone's face. And that's what I love about improv.
They see that happen.
They see it happening. Yeah. They know that they've got nothing and they see them find it. And that's my favorite thing in improv is when you've got absolutely nothing, the audience knows it and you find it.
So what are you lacking in your stand-up practice that you would like to have?
How to narrow it down. compare skills. I don't feel at all confident in comparing.
Odd for an improviser.
Yeah, it doesn't. I don't find that it translates that well, really, for me. Just confidence. Like I say, like when I'm singing and when I'm at the piano with a song, I feel completely comfortable and confident. And when I'm standing with a mic, just sort of talking, I would never get that level of confidence apart from the odd gig. Like I had one gig at Christmas at Always Be Comedy. It's always be comedy, isn't it? It's always a lovely gig. But, I was headlining, which already I think someone's given you a sense of confidence by putting you on as a headliner.
Yep.
And I wasn't all doing material. I was just kind of, I was improvising and just making jokes about what was happening in the ether. And I was chatting to the audience and I was in that free flow state that it feels like other comedians get more often. And that was one of those gigs where you're like, oh, I'm doing the right thing. Oh, I am a comedian. And it just comes from confidence. And I felt like a rock star. And if I could just have that level of confidence to just, you know, go into other places, not to rely completely on all my material and to just sort of chat and be free and let what comes into your head come into your head. And the bits that they were laughing at was not my prepared material. It was the stuff that was coming off the top of my head. But it just takes more confidence than I've got at the moment.
And what does it satisfy in you, in your personality, when it works?
Well, even though I say like I'm not like a sort of outgoing, sort of like funny, loud person, I think I am a show off. I am a bit of a show off, really. And I've always enjoyed performing, like even from when I started learning piano when I was really tiny. And in school plays, even when I was five in the school play, I loved it. I loved being on stage. So I think stand-up's just, it's a part of that. But it's all mine. I think that's what I like about it, is that you have like shit years, like the Live in Vegas year where I felt like shit, but I owned it. Like it was my shit and it was my fault. And at least I got to sort of wallow in it. And there was no one else to blame.
That is an incredible potential opening line. This is all my fault.
It's all my fault. But there's a satisfaction in owning your shit, and there's a satisfaction in owning the good bits as well. And so as someone who definitely, even when I say, well, I don't think I was born to be a comedian, I do think I love being on stage. I love being on stage, whether it's acting or music or singing or comedy. I love people watching me perform. And so if you're doing stand-up or solo comedy or whatever it is, like having that experience that you get from any stage performing, but it's all yours, that's what I like about it.
So do you think you're running towards something rather than running away from something as a comic?
I don't know what you mean.
I'm applying a completely arbitrary rule that I've decided. I tend to think that most comics are either running towards or away from.
Yeah, I think I'm running towards. I don't know. I've never, you know, people say like, what do you want to do? What's the end game? And I haven't really got an end game. I just know that I like performing and I'm getting better at it. All the different, all of the different forms of performing, I'm getting better at the more I do them. So, I haven't got it's not like I've got one overarching ambition that I want to hit, but I definitely want to keep doing what I'm doing.
Which other comedian or performer would it be most narratively satisfying if they killed you?
Ooh, so like that it'd make a really good story.
Yeah.
Another musical comedian. That'd be quite good.
You got anyone in mind?
Well, I've known Carly Smallman a long time, for the longest time in comedy. Helen Arney. Me and Helen Arney used to be in a group together called the Balconettes.
I've heard that name.
Yeah. Danielle Ward was in it as well. There might be a sort of wonderful poetry if Helen Arney killed me as well, because she's so delightful. Her and Carly Smallman, the two most delightful people. Just be surprising.
And finally then, what would you have, and you can interpret this however you like, What would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
My comedy gravestone? Oh, God. I know what I'd have. I'd have the most infuriating comment that a musical comedian can ever receive after a gig, which I now have just come to enjoy because of its cliche quality, which is, "You've got a lovely voice." Thank you.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
So that was Rachel. Remember, her show is on at the Soho Theatre, Best Laid Plans. You can get along and see that soon. That's on the 6th to the 8th of March. And you can find out all of your tour information on my solo stand-up show from comedianscomedian.com/tour. The discount code for all but one or two of those venues is VERA, in capital letters, V-E-R-A. That gets you a healthy discount off your ticket price. And that code also works at Soho Theatre if you fancy coming to see Paul Chowdhury on the 20th of February. That's all of the advertising. Thanks to everybody. Thanks, Daryl, for your help in editing the show. Thank you to Matt Hoss, Livy and Emily, and I don't know why I dignified Matt with us. I just gave Matt his surname and not anyone else there. Livy Phipps and Emily Crosby, I very much appreciate their logging help. Exciting news about merch opportunities coming up soon. Oh my God, I've started working with a really exciting designer, and I'll tell you all about those. Could be a new t-shirt, could be a special little extra thing as well. So that's all to come. Hope to see you at the tour. If you are coming to the tour, remember I'm going to do some little Q&As afterwards in the second half. I'll do a bit of new material, get some feedback from you on that, and then I'll do some little off-the-record Q&As about the podcast like we did last time. That was tremendous fun. So if you are coming to the live show, stick around, come and say hi, and I'll see if my guess is, as I look out into the crowd at the beginning of the show, as to which ones of you are podcast fans are correct when I meet you afterwards. So thanks a lot. I will chat to you if you'd like to stick around for the post-amble, but otherwise, that concludes this episode. Cheerio. So, here I am in my little car with the rain beating down. It feels quite exciting. It feels quite mythic somehow. I mean, I am next to an A road. I don't know how archetypal that feels. I'm on the road, man. I'm on tour. It's really exciting. I hoovered my car a couple of days ago. That was a little pre-tour ritual, perhaps. And now the tour has started. I listened back. You know, I said earlier on, I revised the show as I was driving and listening. I've been doing lots of revision. I've got these two top secret big old guests, both with huge back catalogues of stuff. So I've been trying to write my own stuff, prep the tour and research them. And I was listening to the recording of Compared to What, my Edinburgh show from last Edinburgh. And, bits of it really made me laugh. I mean, is that good? Is that alarmingly self-indulgent? There were some bits, obviously, I'm very, very familiar with because they've morphed into my club set, and some other bits I'd sort of
if not forgotten, there were certain ways I was performing them that made me giggle. Something very funny happened in the room and I listened to it and surprised myself with what I'd improvised. Jesus, how self-indulgent can you get? But I, the stuff's making me laugh out loud, and maybe at the end of the day, that's what you have to do. If you can write a joke and then forget it, rediscover it, and it makes you laugh, that's got to be the sign of something, good or bad. Who can say? So I was listening to it, and at the end of that, at the end of the recording, I was so elated. I was like, God, I love this show. I love the end of it. I love the way the resolution of the show. I love what it says, the stuff that's about the Boutros, and I'm really made up with it. I'm looking back on the content of it now and going, yes, that is how I felt, and that is what happened, and that's very, very exciting. And then I listened to a little bit of it again today, and I suddenly thought, God, I wonder if anyone's going to be at the gig, and I started to get all nervous, and some of these venues have sold really, really well. Even Pool, much maligned Pool. I mentioned last week we'd not sold that many. Pool, even Pool, where I have never done a tour show before, is on 29 tickets. That's a gig. And maybe a bit of walk-up, we might hear 40. Good for you, Pool. I'm sorry I ever doubted you. So the tour is ahead of me, and this is me kicking it off. And it's going to be a nice full room in Southend. As I mentioned, I'm going to do the show straight through Wallop, and then in the second half some newer stuff. I've not really, that's what I should go and do now, rather than chat to you at length. I should go and assemble that so that I can make the most of the second half. But I'm just very, very grateful of my lot. I tell you what's interesting, these two huge guests, sorry to keep dangling these in front of you, one of them is not entirely cleared for official release. The other one, it's such a big deal to me that I want to make sure it's in the can before I tell anyone. Both of them, I've been, you know, watching perform incredible comedy, often to huge rooms of people, DVDs and so forth, to, you know, massive gigs. And I've really been delighting in that thing that I mention all the time, and who knows to whom it can be attributed, that idea of a gig being of like the best moments of a comic's life, being trying new stuff in front of a crowd and having it work, that moment being the same for me as it is for Louis C.K., not one of my big two guests just at this stage, as it is for any of us. So it's been really interesting watching massively famous, successful people on DVD this week and really submerging myself in that, spotting the tropes, trying to get to grips with analysing their style, the decisions they're making, the things they're relying on, the things that they maybe could rely on in a different way. You know, what the things they're doing, the things they're not doing, and feeling that I'm part of that in whatever small and, you know, I'm not going to say small and humble. Stu, I've got to try to not be too self-deprecating. But at the end of the day, this tour isn't me playing 5,000 seater venues, right? So we can all accept that. But I'm still part of it. And everyone that emails me, I ran into someone today whose name I won't say because I haven't sort of checked with him, but he's out there and he'll know who this is. I ran into someone who's on his like sixth gig, and he did a comedy course because he wanted to do a best man speech and not be nervous. So he was like, oh, I'm really terrified of speaking in public and I've got to be funny. I'll do a comedy course. And now he's six gigs in. How exciting is that? This is my point. That guy, me, CK or Rock or whoever it is, that moment of taking the plunge and walking out there, it's the same. That same sensual experience. That's the same moment. And that really makes me feel connected to something. So for all of you who, and I think the list now is, we're in the high 40s, people who got in touch with me and said that this show has given you any kind of a nudge or a little push to get out there and try it, I just wanted to remind you people of that in particular. And anyone else who's considering doing it, go on. Go on, just jump in. It's bloody great. Even when it's awful, it's great. Even when that's how you can tell a comedian. Now, who said that? Some famous comic said, you can tell a comedian because they go out, they die on their ass, they come off and they go, let me back up there. And that's really magical. So with that thought in mind, I can't go off to this show now with the spectre of someone dying on their arse and not minding clanging in my ears. Let's instead remember a little positive thing before I leave you. I mean, it is, I know that's broadly positive, but I've got to have a bit more spring in my step. Did I ever tell you about Senmaru? Did I tell you? If I did, and it's on like episode 120 or something, then forgive me for saying this again, but it's been in my mind because I've been saying it to the Boutros. He's been learning to climb stairs. And
so I've been repeating a version of this to him. This is a thing that I used to say to myself way back in 2010 before I would go on stage every night doing my first ever hour of stand-up. I'll tell you the thing I've bastardized. I'm sorry if you've heard this before. If you're listening back to episodes, you've heard it recently, maybe. Senmaru is a Japanese juggler. He does old school Japanese circus tricks. Really beautiful, balancing a teapot on a mouth stick, making a little silver metal ring dance on a parasol. Beautiful, beautiful things. And one of his lines, which I would just loved, he would do a trick and then he would go, this next trick, and he speaks in a sort of, I don't know how much English he has. He's obviously learned his show. I think he has a little bit of English. I will try not to be offensive in my representation of how he speaks. But he says, this next trick, very difficult, very hard, almost impossible. And he looks the audience in the eye and he says, but I am Senmaru, 39, single. If I try, I can do. And I just, the narrative of this guy's act is wonderful, and you're just completely behind him. And I used to say that to myself very hard, to write a show, to write an hour of stand-up comedy, very hard. This was, you know, maybe less so now, but certainly in those days, I mean, it is still bloody hard, but back then it was like, is this even possible? Very hard to write an hour of stand-up. To go through all that thing, to write all the stuff that you then cut, to say what you want to say, to write a novel whilst being punched in the face. That's what it feels like sometimes. Very hard, almost impossible. But I am Senmaru. 39. Betrothed, in my case. If I try, I can do. And I've been saying this to the Boutros as he climbs the stairs, and he's been happily gurgling away and ignoring me. So let me, as I walk out into my, as I cross this horrifically rainy, dark A road, hopefully successfully, and begin this month's tour, which will be the longest tour, including even the UK dates, but certainly including the Melbourne dates. It will be the longest tour. It's akin to another two more Edinburgh festivals. This is me. Off we go. Very hard. Almost impossible. But if I try, I can do.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.